Alan Gring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Autumn Semester 2016. Lecture 2, delivered on August 25, 2016. The title of this lecture is Foundations of Finance.
Today, Foundations of Finance. Madam, you have decided that you want to own a truck and to make money doing stuff with your truck. What's your last name?
Hammy.
Hammy and her truck. That's the name of what you're going to do. You go out and you do truck things. You take stuff from one place to another for people. You know, occasionally, if someone pays you enough, you'll run over an enemy of theirs, things like that. You know, nice. Sometimes you'll just kind of drive your truck around with signs for different companies on them just to advertise their stuff. But you don't have an organized business, but in fact you do. In fact, what you're doing is the largest, in terms of number, kind of business in the entire world. It's called a sole proprietorship. A sole proprietorship is just one person doing something. It's informal to a certain extent. Well, in many cases, it is so informal that the people doing it don't even realize that what they're doing is a legitimate or semi-legitimate business. In fact, it doesn't even have to be a legitimate business. Most criminal operations are sole proprietorships or some form of poorly organized partnership. But the sole proprietorship is characterized by one person who is all at risk, all at risk. So in other words, you pull into someone's, a rich person's driveway to deliver something, and you run over the person's little poodle dog, expensive. You're driving along and then ka-chunk, yay, yay, yay. Well, you see, that person can sue you for mashing the doggy and having to repair it and all that kind of stuff, fix the dog. They'll take your truck, and then they'll go right after any other assets you personally own until they're satisfied that the liability is covered. That's all at risk. You get all the money, and you take all of the risk of the operation. Now, in a formal, you can actually run sole proprietorships just as, well, who do I make the check out to? I make it out. Well, you make the check out to me. But you can also create a fictitious name, and it can be registered with the state in which you are doing your business. In some states, it's called a fictitious name. In other states, it's called an assumed name. And it's actually not a tough process. I've done it for several companies that I have organized here in Illinois. Essentially, what you the process is pretty straightforward. It's online now. You fill out this short form. What's the name of this business you want to run, and you give it a DBA, a doing business as. And then you tell them, well, this is my real name and this is my real address. And then you take it down to the county clerk, where it's done at the county level, these are. And the county clerk says, okay, we've got your paperwork. Now you have to publish this name and see if anyone challenges it. Yeah. Doing business as a DBA. And in fact, you'll see, interestingly enough, if you're looking through documents, financial documents of companies, you'll sometimes see that there is a formal name of a company, and then there might be DBAs and all of that, doing business as. So in the case of my companies, I would just go down and the county clerk, the recorder, I think it was, So all right, you have to publish this. And so you find some business publication in the state. There are quite a few of these that do this kind of stuff. All they do is you pay them, I think it was $33 at the last time I did this last. And they publish for several weeks. This person is claiming this fictitious name. And I'll give you a specific example. One of mine was Dark Wraith Publishing. Went up for a couple of weeks, and then after a couple of weeks, the publisher did not get any challenges, anyone writing, hey, I use that name. And so he sent me a certificate or a statement. So I took it back down to the county recorder's office, said, here it is. The publisher says there were no challenges, and they stamp it, and you got that name. As a matter of fact, they send you in the mail a really nice card that you can put up. It shows the name of your little company and all that, and your name and the business address. So it's you can do it formally like that. And in fact, I found out it wasn't that many years ago. You can even take that to the bank, your bank, and say, "All right, I'm going to get checks with this DBA written on the check." And the bank will say, "Oh, okay, we keep that on file. So when we see these come in, and your signature on them, we know that's your money." So you can do it formally just like that, as with a fictitious name, making it look really legitimate, kind of shielding your own name a little bit. But underneath it, you are still all at risk. The liabilities of the enterprise are your liabilities. I could go into it in a little more detail if you're curious about it, or if you want to create one. Don't do it just on a lark. I mean, I've been using a couple of my DBAs for years for just certain enterprises I run. Okay, now the next one is a partnership. Now, a partnership has to be a little more formal if you want to do it right. You have to file a partnership agreement with the state. This is our partnership. But in other ways, it's very much like a DBA, or rather a sole proprietorship. It's just more than one person, jointly and severally, all at risk. And there are all kinds of variations on partnerships that I will tell you about in the days and weeks to come. But the essential character of it is that it's still an all-at-risk thing. But here's the interesting thing about these two organizational types. You, the four of you, created a partnership. You did a partnership agreement and all of that. You die. I'm not saying it was a noble death. It was a good death.
That's right.
Okay. Actually, no, it wasn't. It was under you were hit by a train when you were drunk. But, you know. Depends on what kind of beer you had before you got hit. That's how noble it was. Okay, look, the partnership is over. It's gone. In a sole proprietorship, when you die, the sole proprietorship is over. The sole proprietorship is exactly as mortal as its owner. The partnership is as mortal as its first to die partner. Well, you say, well, I could roll it. I could will my part to my wife. No, you can't. It doesn't work that way. Now, in these really fancy partnerships like law firms and investment firms, brokerage firms and all that kind of stuff, they have this agreement is set up in such a way from the beginning that the partnership collapses, but then it just rolls back into a new partnership of the same name. You can do it that way, but the original partnership is dead. It is mortal just like you. The sole proprietorship is dead when you die because it is nothing but a veiled representation of you. And just as a comment on the taxes, if you do these right, like a sole proprietorship, you got to recognize the income of your operation, and then you do a Schedule C, it's called. You fill out the revenue and the costs and all that, and then that money flows to, that profit flows to your 1040. as other income. But it doesn't stop there, because you also take that Schedule C income and you put it onto another form called the Schedule SE, which calculates your Social Security tax. And then at the bottom of your 1040, you put that tax on with the tax from the 1040 and add it up. And this is a killer. I will tell you right now, I've done this for a long time. And I'll think I'm okay. And at the end of the year, marginal tax rate applies to my Schedule C income from the business. And then there at the bottom, I've got my tax on my income, both from what doing this and my other operations. And then I've got to add to that that FICA tax, that Social Security tax, and then the Medicare tax, and then the taxes for the full state and the city. And by the time it's over, honest to God, I mean, in some cases, it's just like, unless I am really pulling good income from a sole proprietorship, it's almost like I won't do it, or I will do it on, a lot of people do it on the sly. And that's where you get into the IRS and its efforts these days, because you'll see these, even at these arts festivals and these flea markets and trade shows, you'll have these people coming into your booth just asking all kinds of real friendly questions and talking to you. You know damn well that at least some of them are IRS agents trying to find out who's doing businesses without declaring tax on, declaring income formally. They're almost obvious who it is who's playing when they start asking, well, how much money do you make in this kind of a business you're running? Because I was thinking of doing this myself. I have a feeling you're an IRS person looking for me to disclose that I'm doing this and I'm not reporting my income to you. So there you go. Now, there is the next one I'm going to write here is a corporation. But in the middle here is this thing called an LLC, a limited liability company. They started getting to be a fad that I saw in the 90s. They had been in Europe, and they started getting kind of to be sort of something that, oh, I'm going to form an LLC because that is a cool thing. They can get really complicated, and also most formations of LLCs are actually defective in their creation, because typically an LLC is something that lasts only a certain period of time and then it's supposed to collapse, it's supposed to die, it's supposed to go away. But these LLCs that are formed are like, well, we're going to keep this going forever. Another pain in the butt, well, okay, first of all, with an LLC, you have to file a articles of formation. It's like a partnership agreement, except it's with these. They're not called partners, they're called members, the owners are. And the weird thing, the trick with an LLC, and I won't go into this in too much detail, but you can actually separate for different owners what owners get income, get money as the company makes money, and what owners get just what's at the end of the company when it collapses, which is a trick that you can't do with a corporation. And that's kind of, so some investors are investing in it for the income that flows in as like partnership income. But then there are others who are just there, they put the money in and then they ride it on the long ball. So it's got its kind of advantages, but they are fiendishly complicated. And another thing about partnerships, sole proprietorships, partnerships, and LLCs. Once you're in it, it's really hard to sell yourself, to sell out of it. You can't just say, well, I'm going to sell my membership in this LLC. No, you don't want to do that, because you might run into some serious securities law violations playing that game. Ditto with a partnership. You really can't sell a partnership, because if you sell a partnership, you have essentially removed that partnership. So you'd have to rewrite the partnership. So these are some of the reasons it is pretty difficult to get out from under. And of course, a sole proprietorship, once you're running a sole proprietorship, who's going to buy it from you? How do you unload a sole proprietorship? You really don't. It's just another sole proprietorship if someone pays you money to take it over. Anyway, corporation, the pinnacle of capitalism. A corporation separates ownership from liability. A corporation separates ownership from liability. So if you were a corporation and your corporate truck drove over that dog, they can the owner of the dog can sue only the corporation, not you. There is a corporate veil. As a matter of fact, in your accounting class, they told you assets equal liabilities plus owner's equity. That is the wall. I don't know if they told you that in the accounting, but it is actually a legal wall that protects you as an owner from the problems of the corporation, from its liabilities. That's why you can throw risk into projects like a boss, and if they don't come out, you just walk away. As a matter of fact, this is how a lot of these pseudo-rich people these days are rich. They simply create these entities, they get lots of debt, they pay themselves a huge salary as the CEO and president, and then when the enterprise goes tap city, they just walk away. They don't. It's not their money, it's the corporation that screwed the investors and all of the other liability holders. So they can just wander off with their nice fat income that they've been taking in and putting in the bank and then go on to the next project. That's the modern way to make big bucks. And there's a rather famous person in the news these days who's done it over and over again. I won't mention his name. No one's even offering it. Okay, whatever. But that's how it's played. That's the game. And so if you really want to make a lot of money, of course you're going to make a lot of enemies, but you're also going to have a lot of people who are clueless about how finance works, who will think that you're some guru of business. They'll even make a reality TV show about you where you're the boss. I kid you not. This is how it's done. I watched it happening. Tell you another story. This was actually a personal story. The first consulting job I ever did, when I was at Ohio State, I had gone. I was in a PhD in economics, and I switched over to finance. Well, they said, "Well, you got to take all these basic courses, but we have these advanced versions, accelerated, that you can catch up." One of them was a god-awful accounting course for PhDs and MBAs. There were three people in the class who saw it. It wasn't hard for me at all. It was just kind of like puzzles, but they were struggling. And they said, "Well, you know, you're so good at this. We'd like to see if you would help us with a problem we have." And it turned out they worked for the state of Ohio EPA. And they said, "Okay, we've got this person. He creates a corporation, and then what he'll do is he'll put into it a couple, just one or two huge trucks, and then he'll go around the state and he'll sell the service of taking away toxic liquid waste from companies that create it. He'll just take it off their hands for a big fee." And of course, the companies at that time, environmental regulations were still kind of in an earlier phase in that era. They were just glad, "It's off our shoulders. Here's these giant 55-gallon drums. Take them away, please." Well, what he would do is he would take these barrels with, I guess his son was involved in it, two sons were involved in it too, drive them out to the woodlands and the wetlands in Ohio, and they would just dump them out on the ground. Just dump them out. And then take off. Well, the EPA would catch up with him doing this. They would fine him enormously. Well, they weren't fining him. They were fining his corporation. So once the fines came in, he had, of course, been paying himself these massive salaries, insane salaries, and buying himself stuff on the company tab and for his boys, too. Well, as soon as those massive fines came in, the corporation would just go bankrupt, declare bankruptcy. We can't pay it. We're out of business. And that meant that the fines were then thrown out because the fines were to the corporation, which had died, which had gone bankrupt. And he had been doing this for like 5-7 years. They said, can you create the kind of evidence that these aren't really corporations at all? They're merely collapsible, phony corporate vehicles, and he is really the owner. We want to take him to court and have a court pierce the corporate veil. In other words, a court is reticent to do this. Understand, a court doesn't like to do this. But if there is evidence that the individuals who are the owners are merely using the corporation to hide their own ownership of the core business entity, Well, a judge can pierce the corporate veil. Well, I thought I was the boss. I thought I can do this. And I created some good numbers and evidence and all this kind of stuff. And I went in as an expert witness. And his lawyers, I should have asked them to autograph the boot mark they put on my ass. They just creamed me on the witness stand. They just destroyed me. I walked out of there about 2 feet tall. Oh, boy, that was fun. I'm not kidding. I mean, you know, I got humble real fast in that environment. And, of course, you know, went on. He just kept doing it. Went into the 90s doing this. It was just, it was a way to hide his personal ownership. It wasn't really a corporation. We all knew it. But because he did it by the numbers, and he didn't actually tap into the corporate funds, he just paid himself massive salaries, executive salaries, from the corporate funds that were flowing in. And of course, when the company went bankrupt, all the state got were the assets, which were, of course, one or two trucks that were so toxic they had to wear hazmat suits to drive them off his property. So there you go. That gives you an idea of how strong the corporate veil is and how if you've got the money, you can protect yourself under the banner of a corporation and enrich yourself. And in this case, at the detriment of the incredible detriment of the environment. There is kind of a good ending to this story. In the late 1980s, that fellow died of brain cancer. Seems that those toxics had been eating him away all his life. So there was some pleasure in that. But at the corporation. Yeah, go. With another corporation. I mean, I've done it. You don't call it the same thing. I mean, that'd be a little bit gutsy. But, I've had companies, corporations, and when I was a consultant, it's actually mathematical. One of the things that, I don't know if they'll teach it to you in the accounting program here, but one of the things that you do in good financial analysis is work with the accountants to work out when a bankruptcy trigger will occur optimally for the owners. And in other words, then from there, what would be the next step might be to create another corporation that buys the assets off of the corporation that went bankrupt, pays off the debt holders at some pennies on the dollar, and then goes back into business again. Absolutely. That's a very good point you're making there, because the accounting, you have to have the tax dogs do this, because they're going to do, and also, what was I thinking? Oh, in real estate finance, which is one of my specialties back in the day, we would actually, one of the sheets that we would calculate would be the one called Tax Consequences of Bankruptcy. And it became actually part of the cash flow analysis. So you said, well, what's the net present value of this project with all these cash flows in and out going through it? One of those was the assumption of and probability for a bankruptcy of, say, a little strip mall you were buying. Oh, yeah. And I've done it myself a few times. I don't want to do it again because it never worked out for me. I do want to point out something, though. First round on this right here. Liabilities come first. Owners come last. So we say that the debt holders have the prior claim to cash flows.
Excuse me. Denny's breakfast coming back.
Prior claim to cash flows. And the equity owners, the equity, that's the owners, the stockholders, whatever it is, the partners, the sole proprietor, has the residual claim. In day-to-day business, what this means, in day-to-day business, you have to pay your debts in a timely manner. You got a payment to make that payment. Then you can give some dividends to the stockholders. That's all it is. That's the reality of it. You cannot, okay, a company doesn't pay a stockholder. I had many, many times as a consultant when I had to deal with stockholders who were really furious. They weren't getting dividends. It happens. Early in a company's life, it's probably not going to pay dividends because it's trying to plow back. It's trying to cover its debts. It's probably gotten a lot of debt to start with. It's trying to plow money back into R&D. It doesn't have any money for dividends. I was at this company that I was consulting for. The officers and the directors wanted me to be the one who spoke with the shareholders at the annual meeting to field their questions about technical matters. Well, the first thing they do is they start yelling about dividends. When are we going to start getting dividends? This one woman, she was just yelling, and she got really furious. You know, I've had this stock for 4 years now, and I haven't seen a dime off it. Where are my dividends? And, you know, I have to be diplomatic. I just said, look, bitch, these things... what am I supposed to say? We'll give you all the dividends, and then we'd have nothing for R&D. We give you the dividends, and we don't pay our debt. Here's the thing is, those shareholders can't do a thing to you except yell at you. They're the owners. What are they going to do? Sue the company? Well, they're suing themselves if they do that. All they can do is whine and fuss. These debt holders are different. You don't pay them... They can shoot your dog, sell your Bible on Craigslist, and make your mother wear furry costumes that please them. They'll destroy you. You don't pay them, they'll just take you to court and shut your company down. Debt has prior claim on cash flows. Equity has residual claim. In other words, you're buying an equity position, you're buying stock on a hope and a prayer. You invest in the debt. Now, this is why... Debt financing is cheaper than equity financing because the debt holders are at lower risk than the shareholders. So if you see a company that is issuing stock, well, they're just coming out with this IPO or they're just selling 1 million shares or 100 million shares. First thing you ask is, why are you doing that? Equity is insanely expensive compared to debt. As far as financing goes, a corporate bond float maybe 6%, 8%. The cost of equity capital, we'll do that in this class, you back into it, and your jaw will drop. 22% for equity, the cost of equity capital, and new equity is even costlier than existing equity. You're burdening the corporation with very high cost capital when you equity finance. There's a reason why you would. Truly, but the first question I always ask when a company announces, we're going to sell 100 million shares of stock, why are you doing that? You can't go and get a loan at a bank, can you? Oh, there are a couple other reasons too. Okay. You are one of the corporate finance executives. You decided to major in finance. You rose to the top. You've got a decision to make. You want to raise money through a stock offering, okay? Here's been the stock price. Now, if you expect the stock to go up, you could sell the stock at this price. Or if you expected the stock to collapse after the offering, you could sell it at this price. So you can sell it at a low price, A, or you can sell it at a high price, B. Which are you going to choose to do? Exactly. You're going to sell it at the top. And then those shareholders who have just bought your Facebook stock or whatever stock it is, they ride that dog down the sled. See. So when I see an offering of common stock going out, I usually will think to myself, okay, first, you can't raise debt capital. Second, you're going to sell near the top to get as much money per share as you can, because you're betting that if you wait, it could end up down here and you won't get that much money per share on the sale. Okay? This is a cynical approach to investing. And it's actually one of those things that you just have to think about. That doesn't mean that you don't buy stock. It just means that you have to walk into it with your eyes wide open and know the incentives of the corporation that are involved in any kind of a sale of any time they raise capital. There are a lot of questions that you might want to ask whenever you're seeing companies raising money. Some of those questions are real cynical. Some of them are more with this might be a good idea, but let's look into it. So the next thing I'm going to show you here, and I caution you, be careful about these sites like Yahoo Finance. They can give you some basic numbers. I'm sure some of you have already done this. But you also, the originating source for financial information is actually on the SEC's Edgar site. And I'll talk about that in a little bit here. But these are just basic stock screens we're going to look at here. And we'll do one. Anyone got a company you would like to see the current screen for? No, you know what's going to happen. Okay, you know watch this. Wait. You do know why I... Burke, I can't read this screen. Let me try it again. Berkshire Hathaway. Is that it? And I think it's B is the one that you're thinking of, isn't it? No, it was A. Okay. Berkshire. It was A. Well, that didn't work. Let's try that again. Burke. There it is. There you go. There's your price per share. $222,998 per share. Now, let me point out two terms, round lot and odd lot. Round lot is a multiple of 100 shares. You buy in round lots. If you buy an odd lot, you're going to pay more for it. So a round lot of this is 100 shares. So what would that be? $22,998,000. Okay, you ready to pay that? You got to check under the seat of your car. No, stop it. Okay, let's try something else. NFLX, let me do Netflix. Is there some reason, do I need a hand crank for this computer? Okay. 97.86, in other words, each share of this right now is at 97.86. That's not exactly how it will work though. See the bid and the ask? The ask is what you will pay for it. The bid is what you will get if you sell it. Now, that's usually a very tight spread, although I think it was spring semester, the first one I pulled up, the bid-ask spread was like almost a buck. And I thought, how does that happen? But this is essentially, if you're going to buy it, you pay a higher price than if you're going to sell it. That's the margin for the traders that do this kind of stuff. And there's not a lot to say, more to say. Well, yes, I am going to say it because This is a close yesterday. And so what you would do is you would say, all right, this is against this. So in other words, since the close yesterday, what we sometimes call the settle on the day previous, you got this number, okay? So in other words, since then, the stock price has gone up about 2.82%. Now remember, I don't know if you've been told this, actual dollar figures don't mean a whole lot to us. Because, I mean, a $1 rise on a $10 stock is a whole lot different from a $1 rise on a $100 stock. We really care about the percentage gains and losses. That's where the action is. And a 2.82% gain is a decent gain for the day. However, you've got to keep in mind that that was just one day. Over a period of time, it's going to go up and down and up and down. What your hope is that you can have a general trend upward appreciation of the capital gain, commensurate with the risk. Now, you see this range here. Once you do this for a while, you get kind of a sense of it. This is a pretty tight range in here. Some stocks really swing hard over over even a day's time. Now, the 52-week range, well, there's an interesting thing. Its 52-week range is $79.95 per share to $133.27 per share. Okay, now this is where it gets a little bit more interesting to us. Talk to me. Where is its current price relative to its 52-week range?
It's a little towards the lower side.
I think so. It's all close to the middle, but if I did the calculation, I'd say, yeah, that's a little closer to the down to the low side on it. So there's some information for us that Netflix has lost, has obviously recovered from a heavy downstroke early, sometime in the past year, but it also hasn't really re-achieved where its potential was. Then you start, okay, this is technical analysis, the numbers. Now we start to ask some more serious questions about it. Why would Netflix not be roaring upward? The question is not why is it, but why isn't it? Why isn't this stock doing really well? Why didn't it bounce off its low and just achieve Mount Everest? What are the factors involved? And most of you would know this. Talk. Go. Oh, yeah, that really irritated the hell out of me, you know. I'm watching Murdoch Murder Mysteries, and I have to pay $2 more. Fortunately, it was a great episode I had to watch. So, anyway, yeah, they brought their price up. Did they lose customers? Well, what happened? Does Netflix have any competitors?
Yeah.
Who?
Hulu came out.
Hulu? Okay. Did Hulu say it?
Amazon Prime.
Yes, absolutely. And their Acorn service? HBO, uh-huh. So in other words, did they raise their prices? All of them across the board do what Netflix did and jack their prices up?
No, I just saw that HBO created their own thing like
that. Okay, the bottom line there is that Netflix took a bet and raised its prices, and it was hoping for customer loyalty that people wouldn't just bail and say FTS, fancy that scenario. I'm going to drop this and go on to Hulu Plus or just something like that, okay? On the other side, now this is both opportunity and risk. This part you'd have to see in some documents I'm going to show you later. Netflix just raised over $1 billion in debt capital. Raised over $1 billion. But that $1 billion is sitting there on the balance sheet. It's just sitting there right now. Why would a company just almost like out of nowhere just announce and do an offering of over $1 billion worth of debt securities? Or do they just want to have the executives swim in a giant swimming pool full of money? Okay. Clearly, that creates risk because whenever you take on debt, you've got risk that you got to pay it off. You got to be able to pay the debt, the coupon payments, and the principal value of it. What would Netflix have been thinking of? Can you think of anything? Did it just take it on just so it could pay more bills every month?
Stock prices go up?
No, actually might. Leverage, gains to leverage can cause that to happen. But business decision, go. Oh, well, expansion in other countries might, yes. Is there anything else that might be going on? Go.
They might be looking at different years and see if they have more money. If they're, rising, so that stockholders would be attractive.
That's, by the way, that's actually not as uncommon as you think it is. The idea that you give a company this swollen look of money, of essentially what we call liquidity, and that will draw equity investors in. If I see someone walking down the street with a pile of money in his pocket, well, I'd like to be his friend. That's why I'm not your friend. You don't have a pile of money in your pocket. But that liquidity attraction, that's a good point. Go. No, they're not buying the competitor's debt. They are actually borrowing money from the giant banks of the world, the investment bankers. They're borrowing fresh, clean, new money. Think like a predator. Go.
Buy a competitor out?
Oh, there you go. There's a possibility. Go. Well, that would be essentially acquiring an interest, a stake in another company. Go.
Invest in more research.
Research or? What does Netflix do? Where is their big thing? Go. There is a possibility. Are they trying to link up Mary with Disney? Oh, that would be really weird. Netflix and a mouse? I don't even want to think about that. That's just nasty, man. Okay, go. Okay, now you're beginning to get to the ideas. If you think like a predator, you would think, yeah? My cynical side says there's always that possibility, but it seems that Netflix, if you've noticed that Netflix has all of these lame movies, you can stick with it for about a month and you've seen everything that's decent to see on there. So where they have been doing their most activity is in these quote-unquote original series. That they've, Longmire, what are some of the other ones that they've done? Okay, so what do you need to make a television series?
Actors.
What else?
Money.
What? You need a studio. You need a big studio. You need a studio like on the size of maybe a Paramount. Or something like that. Now they can pay for their own building of a complete studio for all of these original series, or they could buy one and the talent behind it that's already standing. That's a possibility. Another one is what you were bringing up, that they're just trying to make themselves look high liquidity. In other words, a lot of cash to attract equity. Another possibility is that they're looking at one of their competitors to either buy a stake in it or to make a hostile takeover move for it, and they would have to wait until one of their competitors had shown some kind of real weakness and the stock price had slid, and then they could go in and try to strike fast and hope that the competitor couldn't find a white knight to bail it out. But there are a lot of possibilities, but then you begin to think about it. Okay, they got all this money. Is this a bad sign or is this a good sign? The stock price is closer to its bottom than its 52-week bottom than it is to its 52-week top. Those are the kinds of things you start to ask yourself in fundamental analysis. In other words, going beyond the numbers to ask the kinds of questions about whether you should buy, sell, or if you have it, hold. What are you bitching about to me here? Oh, there. Okay, look. I'm going to point out something. One of the things you'll find out in my when I do courses is I will bring up concepts long before they are in. I bring them up formally. I will just say them, or I'll talk about them for a little bit. And then I'll back off, and then I'll bring it up again. I layer it so that by the time you see it formally, you're comfortable with it. You're a lot more comfortable. One of the things I'm going to show you right now is this little thing right here. You see it? That's called beta. Beta is a measure of risk. But it's not just any risk. It is the risk that you should expect to be rewarded for bearing. Beta is the risk that you should expect to be rewarded for bearing. If you buy a single stock, most of the risk of that stock will be risk that you should not expect to be rewarded for, because you could get rid of it through portfolio diversification. You buy a single stock, you are an idiot, because you are bearing risk that has nothing whatsoever to do with the expected return. When I was in the Illinois State Students in Finance, they would have these competitions. Well, whoever gets the highest return on their investment, their fake investments, wins the prize. What a bad idea, a bad way to teach finance students. All that matters is how high your return is, how much risk did they bear, one, and how much of that did they need not bear. We have all these television shows, financial TV shows on the Financial News Network. Well, this fund manager had the highest performing portfolio last year. Doesn't matter to me. I don't care. Because he might have had a very high risk portfolio. High risk, high return. But it's not just how much risk. It was how much of that risk he could have gotten rid of. In some of these portfolios, I've seen that they think these guys are gurus. Most of the risk, they were putting their investors at insane risk for a high return, and a lot of that risk that they had was not even risk that was going to be rewarded. But they won, so you'll have these trading gurus. I've got a software system that I'm going to sell you, and I've made $1 million off it, and I'm going to share my secrets with you. For every one of those who's a winner, there are probably 10,000 who are losers. Guarantee you that's the way it is. But they're not going to get up there. I want to sell you my system where I lost my butt. Now, they're not going to do that. All you're going to hear is from that few that win. And, of course, you're going to have someone win at the craps table, even though it's a completely random thing that's happening. Beta, let me give you an idea. A perfectly riskless security would have a beta of zero. Now, what would be a perfectly riskless security? Well, it's a theoretical thing, but pretty darn close would be a short-term treasury bill. In other words, you lend the government money for a year, you're going to get your money back. The government will pay you back. It's a riskless debt instrument. The government will print money to pay you back. Raise taxes, maybe, to pay you back. Oh, of course, these days we'll just attack some country and say that it was, and take its assets. Not mentioning any, but Iraq. You'll get your money back. So we consider a treasury bill to be like a risk-free security. And, of course, its yield is ridiculously low, like 0.1%. Now, a beta of 1. The other leverage point on what's called the capital market line, that would be a theoretical thing. It's a portfolio of all of the securities, of the equity of the world economy, and each one in the portfolio in proportion to its contribution to the total capitalization of the world portfolio. In other words, you would own everything. And everything would be in exactly, your portfolio would be in exactly a miniature of the world. Now, of course, you can't do a market portfolio, a true one, but you can come close. You can buy into mutual funds and these things called ETFs that are very close to market portfolio, about a beta of 1. A beta above 1 Think of one as sort of the fulcrum. A beta above one would be a risky portfolio, a risky stock. A beta below one would be a safer, more conservative kind of stock. And of course, when you build your portfolio, you build it on betas that are kind of near each other, and the weighted average of them would be the beta of your portfolio. Which brings us to an interesting question that I pose to, I'll start with you, my good future finance major. Okay, not finance major. What kind of a beta are you? What would be your beta of a portfolio that you built?
I'd say conservative.
Well, give me a number. Like maybe a 0.7, a 0.8.
Yeah.
Okay. What would you say? Okay, how about you? Interesting. You are conservative. Here's the deal. Early in your life, we expect you to be aggressive risk takers in your investments because even if you get creamed, you would have time to recover. You would have time to get back. So we would anticipate hearing you calling out numbers like 1.3, 1.5. But we don't these days, interestingly enough. And this is something that fascinates me. This is why I actually asked the question. I asked this 20 years ago. You would have heard calls of 1.4, 1.7. But a lot of younger people now are much more, consider themselves more conservative. Now, think about it this way. When you get to be like 50, 60 years old, we don't want to advise you to have betas of your portfolio in the high range. We want you to be backing off because we want your investments to be relatively safe so that you have something to eat in your retirement and you don't have time to recover from a high-risk loss. So we would anticipate that older investors, they would be conservative. But we expect you cats to be more aggressive, and we don't see it as much as we used to or as much as our theory would expect us to. Interesting as it is, you've become much more conservative, and that's part of the social culture of our time that's sort of beaten the risk-taking out of you, scared it out of you. But we do understand this. Now, let me show you something. I want to show you something else here. Right here. Is there some reason this is so tiny I need an electron microscope to read it? There it is, market cap. This font just sucks.com. No, I don't want it. I wanted to find the how I magnify this a little bit. Say what? Hold shift.
Control.
Okay. Whoa! There we go. Don't get old like me. I mean, just put yourself in a home somewhere so you don't embarrass yourself. Look, market cap is the price per share times the number of shares outstanding. That's all market cap is. Market cap is the price per share times the number of shares outstanding. Essentially, it is the market's determination of the equity value of that company. It is the market's current determination of the equity value of that corporation. Now, you'll hear these stock gurus say, well, I think this stock is undervalued by the market. Oh, you do? Hundreds of thousands of the best and brightest traders on the planet, 24/7, with the most powerful computers on Earth, running the most sophisticated software that could be imagined. And you think that the market is wrong. Next thing, you go out there and stand in front of a tsunami that's 50 foot high and say, you're just being irrational. You see, that whole concept is just ridiculous to even say,
well, the market's undervalued today.
Oh, why? How? What is it? Is there some evil little fairy saying, oh, we're going to hold the market down? No. Those traders are going to do everything they can to get it right. Because if they don't get it right, they don't eat. And that's one of the best incentives in the world to do things the right way, is whether or not you eat. Okay? And so you got to imagine that the predatory nature, this is like a living animal. It's assessing second to second what is happening. And as I told you in the last lecture, we now have at least one of these big, big companies that can look a few more than a few milliseconds into the future. They can know that you are going for a stock. The trick is that what they do is that their computers are watching the formation of an assessment by the market. The market's price, let's say, is $2. This is a big magnifying example. $2. There's suddenly the vast majority, the margins of the traders, the best of the traders, think that the price should be $5. They start forming the consensus that they're going to start buying the stock to capture that under that value differential. Saxo's computers see the consensus forming, and they'll get to it and buy it up. And by the time the trades are executed by those who were doing it the other way, they're buying it at $5 a share. And so Saxo can then say, all right, we bought it at $2, and now we'll sell it to these suckers at $5 because we beat them to the watering hole. That's how powerful the market is now. Mother's work is never done. But so the market says that this is a $41.96 billion company. Let's try. Okay. Google, it's called Alphabet now. I've got to get that in my mind. There's Alphabet. That used to be called Google. Its trading symbol is still G-O-O-G. There is its price per share, $769.39. So if you want to buy a round lot of that, it's going to cost you $78,000-$79,000 with your transactions cost. And remember, you are going to pay a transaction cost on the buy and then on the sell. So you're going to pay it. So recognize that you don't have to sell. You buy it at $769.39. You don't make money at $770. You make money once it has climbed out of the pit of the transactions cost you paid for it. Also, you're going to have to take into account how much time and money did you spend determining that this stock was worth buying, your opportunity cost. A lot of day traders, they don't take into account that they spend their whole lives doing this. So taking that into account, they think they've made a lot of money. Well, they could have probably been doing something else and made more, but there you go. It's a hobby, or it's a passion, I should say. It's not a hobby, it's a passion. Okay, now, beta of the stock is NA, which is kind of weird, because I think it's because of the name change. But let's look at its market cap. $528.78 billion. In other words, more than half $1 trillion this one corporation is worth. More than half $1 trillion. Let's put into the mix Apple. Really? Do I actually have an internet here, or do I have to hold up an antenna? Apple's market cap. What is that? $578.75? You put those two companies together, two corporations, and the market cap, the value of those is over $1 trillion. Just those two corporations. Now, I pose to you this question. My good woman, what are you worth? No, you're not. What are you worth? Net present value. How much life insurance would you buy just so that it would compensate for the present value of your future expected cash flows? $6 million? Okay, well, that's a decent value, $6 million. Compare that to over $1 trillion. You, sir, what are you worth? $10 million? Okay, well, I could probably sell you on certain markets, shadowy darknet markets for that. Yeah. Is that anywhere close to $1 trillion? I could take all of you in this room. I could take all of you at this college. I could take all of you in this community and add your present values of your future expected cash flows together, and it wouldn't even be a blip on the map of two of the largest corporations on Earth. You put the top 100 together, and I could add up the values of all the people in this country, and it would still be less than those. Take all of the corporations in the top 500 and compare those to the value of all of the people on Earth, the net present value of their future expected cash flows, and I still wouldn't have much in comparison. That's what the world of this current world is all about. These corporations are so much worth so much more than we are that it's almost scary to think about. Look at the beta of Apple. Now, I've taught you a little bit about this. What do you see? What do you see about that beta? You see the beta of it?
I
see two, but it is pretty high risk. It's higher risk than the market portfolio. It's about a third higher risk. So I guess I would call that kind of pretty high risk. Yeah, it's a 1.38. In other words, this company is fairly risky in terms of investment. So you would put this into a portfolio if you wanted to boost the risk of that portfolio overall. Or you would combine this with other stocks like that if you wanted. Let me try something here real quick. I want to bring up. Now, by the way, let me make a point here. Stocks trade on exchanges most of the time. Now, I used to run a penny stock house many years ago. Really lame affair. But the New York Stock Exchange is the cream of the crop. They have the big capitalization firms, and essentially the buying and the selling are very tightly regulated. It's a highly organized market. Other ones like the Amex are a little bit weird because in the Amex, it is actually physical, like the New York Stock Exchange. There's a physical floor. On the Amex, there are specialists who trade only in specific stocks. That's their thing. If I want to buy, let's say, Netflix stock, I would find the specialist for Netflix stock. Now, I might have just gotten an order. The runner gave me the signals for an order. Let's say, I don't know, someone's put in an order for 10,000 shares at, let's say, and they want at or below 100. So I would say, okay, you are the specialist in that stock. So I go up to you. Everyone's yelling at you. You and your people are behind the desk yelling back at them. And I'm yelling, I need 10,000 shares, $100 a share. And you say, I got 101. Can't you see? Look up there on the board, 101. 101 is the best I can do. I need 100. And then someone else trying to buy, he says, I've got some shares. I can do it 100 and 150. I can't do 150. What do you got? He said, okay, I can give you 20,000. Okay, I can give you 2,000 at your price. Okay, I'll take those. So you got a ticket for 2,000. I still need to fill 8,000. And then I just have to step back and see where the ebb and flow is. I hear that the price has gone down to 99. I got 99. I want 99 for 8,000. Shares, okay, you got it. I fill my ticket on 100, 2,000 shares at 100, and 2,000, and 8,000 shares at 99. Big, big mess. Back in my time, they used all kinds of very controversial pharmaceuticals to keep themselves going. It was just insanely high pressure. Okay, now there's another one called the OTC. That's the NASDAQ. There is no physical floor for the NASDAQ. You just go in there. It's all electronic. And there's people trying to sell stock all the time. There's people trying to buy stock all the time on different companies. But these are usually very small companies. Some companies on the NASDAQ are actually enormous. But I worked in the NASDAQ. My penny stock house did NASDAQ stocks. And it was one of those things where, okay, I had people who wanted to get rid of stock. They had bought it at $5 a share. I could give them no more than 25 cents a share for it. And so, and I, you know, that was the best I could do. So they said, no, you just wait until the price goes up. And I would have to just wait and wait for them to be able to fill their orders. Usually I never could. But anyway, it's all about the bid and the ask. In this market, you're seeing these are the nice top of the end range markets, but we'll talk about the lower end markets next week. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.